We're just got married, so. Democrat in Clackamas County. It's been beaten out of me.
Good morning, everybody. We're going to go ahead and get started. I apologize that we're a few minutes late. I found myself stuck on the telephone this morning with one of Representative McEwen's constituents about a burnt building in Winchester Bay. So we'll get to work on that some more after this meeting. So we're going to go hopefully rather quickly today because it's Friday and I know a lot of people would like to get finished. So I think we'll start right off with an informational meeting. I guess I called that to order already. So I'm going to invite up Michael Jordan and Nathan Nix to talk a little bit about the efforts to align state and local economic development strategies and the implementation of House Bill 2620 of the 2013 session. Welcome. Great to see you again. Thank you for being here.
It's good to see you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Jordan. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for the state and the Director at the Department of Administrative Services. With me is Nathan Nix, and he's the project manager on this project, and we'll give you, he's the one who actually knows what he's talking about, so I'll be very brief. Just to give you some context, the committee will recall last session House Bill 2620 was passed and directed us to bring back a plan to the 14 session on how state agencies could align their work more closely with the priorities established by regional solutions committees. There are 11 of those across the state. They've been in place now for some time in different evolutionary manifestations since the mid-90s, actually. And we're preparing to take an even more bold step in partnering with those committees to get to outcomes in communities along the lines of economic and community development policy initiatives. So that was the charge for us. Also in the bill, it established that we should be working on ways to align and work more closely with those committees from our natural resource agencies also. And lastly, the bill mandated that we have a public involvement process also. And Nathan will go into the details of the process itself. Just at a very high level, what we did was we created a steering committee that has both folks inside state government, agencies that are aligned with community and economic development, but also outside stakeholder groups, business groups, some natural resource representation that helped us construct the process. What we used primarily were the plans that have come forward from the regional solutions committees to establish kind of what was the playing field, if you will. What were we working to align to? And through that process of getting all of that information from the regional solutions committees, we really narrowed our work down to three basic areas and then one kind of thread, or two, and one thread that kind of goes through them. One was infrastructure funding and land availability, and then the other was business services, if you will, how we deliver service or our grant and loan programs directly to the private sector, to businesses. And then the thread that runs through all of the discussion was regulatory streamlining, not necessarily the policy behind the regulations, but our job was to look at how we administer them. Are there ways for us to do it in a more expeditious way? Were there ways for us to think about how do we get more certainty into the process? This was not a policy discussion about changing state policy. And then lastly, I want to say to the committee before Nathan gets going, my opinion, we're doing this work at light speed, given the number of constituencies across the entire state, given the fact that we were mandated to go do public engagement on this. Nathan will talk about our roadshow. I think the committee and the legislature should expect that what we bring forward to this session, I would consider a 1.0 version, and that the conversation needs to continue. We need to continue to evolve the way we do business that is more aligned and more engaged with the communities we're trying to serve. And so I would expect that we will be back in 15 with a 2.0 version. We're just moving really fast on this, and so there are going to be recommendations in the form of a statute, but please consider it to be the first step on what I would consider to be a long journey in our collaboration with communities. So with that, Mr. Chair, unless there are questions of me, I'll turn it over to Nathan for offer.
Great, thank you. We'll let them finish up, and I'm sure there'll be questions before you all leave.
Great. Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Nathan Ricks, and I'm the project manager for the implementation plan for House Bill 2620. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today. Before I get started, I'd like to refer you to two handouts that you've been given. The first is a colorful map of the regional solution centers and regional solutions regions, and the second is an executive summary of the project work that we've completed to date. On the map, you'll notice that there are 11 regional solution regions in five different zones, and I'd like to give you just a brief background on these before we dive into the actual priorities. There are seven regional solutions coordinators. You'll notice there are 11 actual regions, so there are several coordinators that have multiple regions. And then there are six centers, which are labeled as stars on the map, in five different zones. And each center has a regional solutions advisory committee, which sets the priorities of the region and gives direction to the coordinators. And so when we talk about regional priorities, it's the priorities that have been set by the regional solutions advisory committees, and those are made up of a broad swath of community members, folks in business and industry, and also local government leaders. So today what I'd like to do is give you an update on the project work that we've completed to date and how House Bill 2620...
Excuse me, I guess we've got a question here.
Excuse me, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Excuse me for interrupting. I'm just trying to look at the map, and the green shades are so close together. Am I seeing this correctly, that Tillamook and Lincoln County is the dividing line between those two areas?
Right here. Mm-hmm. Yes. Members of the committee, yes, that's correct.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sure. So I'd like to continue, members of the committee, with discussing our process to create this implementation plan and then share with you a preview of some of the findings. First, we began this process in response to the bill by focusing on public engagement. The bill specified specifically that we needed to engage the public, and we were given a general fund allotment of $200,000 to do this work. And so we partnered with DHM Research to conduct an interactive statewide survey. In this, we targeted two groups of people. First, practitioners, and these are folks that are program managers and program users. And then we also focused on electeds and appointeds and folks that have a sense of the policy and have heard from constituents about their experience with state government and economic and community development services. In the month of November, we sent this survey out and received quite a bit of feedback. We had over 2,000 responses. And we asked them four main questions. The first was, what is your current experience with economic and community development services? How have you partnered with the state in the past? What does that experience look like? So it was very qualitative, not your sort of standard multiple choice kind of survey. And then we asked them specifically, where have you experienced duplication in your interaction with state government? Where have you experienced fragmentation? And lastly, if you were to improve this experience or redesign the process, what would that look like to you? So the project team took that information, organized it thematically, and then analyzed it and gathered a group of program experts and program users into a one-day summit where we actually had them dive into the data in detail and, using the thematic analysis, create scenarios from the data to make improvements to our economic and community development services. And in that process, we were able to craft about eight scenarios. Our steering team that Director Jordan mentioned earlier was able to help us narrow that that group of scenarios down to three, which we then brought out to five regional meetings across the state. We began in Portland. We had a meeting in Bend, Eugene, LaGrande, and also in Medford, and invited the same 2,000 folks that had responded in the survey, as well as anyone else that wanted to participate. And we focused on validating those scenarios, and then after that, asked them for modifications to those scenarios. We're in the process of really finalizing those, and we'll have that report completed before the 2013 legislature. But I'd like to share with you some of the findings of the survey results. So in general, three out of four participants across the state felt that the priorities established by the Regional Solutions Advisory Committees matched their own understanding of their needs in their communities. We also found that a majority of all regions feel that the state is effective in helping regions and industries meet their priorities, but that more could be done to increase that effectiveness. One in four participants experienced duplication of services across the state. And specifically in southern and eastern Oregon, the regions felt that they would be likely to experience service gaps in the future. So those were the findings just of the 2,000 responses from the interactive survey. The findings, major thematic findings of the regions, were that participants see economic and community development as a competitive process vis-a-vis other states and regions and feel a sense of urgency to make sensible reforms. Second, participants emphasized the importance of the state in coordinating its efforts with local authorities and agencies in support of the locally established objectives. And lastly, there were some general concerns that changing rules and processes could undermine land use and environmental regulations. And with that, I'll end my testimony. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them or provide you with further information.
Well, thank you. I'm sure there'll be some questions. I would like to make a comment, and you sort of touched on it on your last point. One of the big issues in Southern Oregon, where I'm from, is that our industrial lands contain a lot of wetland issues. So you end up having these properties that are developable only after going through the process of wetland mitigation. The length and the cost of that process is prohibited for businesses. So even though we have wonderful opportunities and set aside industrial parks, all these things that you would think would be great for attracting business, when you actually get down to doing the work, the cost and the time of getting the land ready is prohibited. So businesses say, well, you're not ready. So we throw around terms in this building like shovel ready or other terms which really are not accurate. So to the extent the discussion could be had about how we facilitate actually getting property shovel ready, I think at least in my region, it may be different in other panel members, would be incredibly important. So thank you for the work you're doing. I saw Representative Thatcher maybe had a comment to make.
Yes, I actually not a comment, more of a question. I'm just trying to picture this whole process, and you did a pretty good job laying it all out. But where I was trying to envision what the scenarios you're referring to. What are you talking about? Situations like Representative Freeman's talking about, where okay, here's a scenario, and here's how now it has to be dealt with. Here's a better way of dealing with it. Is that what you're referring to? And could you give me an example?
Sure. Members of the committee, Representative Thatcher, the three scenarios we've developed, the first has to do with really scaling up some successes that we've seen through the Regional Solutions projects in the Portland metro area with industrial land site development. And what we're really talking about as far as what the state is doing is aligning the sequence of our loan and grant programs to expedite the process of getting the industrial land sites ready for development. Some other scenarios have to do with creating a flexible funding account, again, using existing state and loan grant programs to be able to address issues, and also creating a better end-user experience by really making a common application for businesses so that when they are applying for, let's say, a permit, that they would be able to enter all that information in one place and not have those duplicative efforts.
If I may, Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Thatcher, the first thing that Nathan mentioned really is the issue that you were bringing up. To really have a parcel ready for development, you're really talking about permit to building in 180 days in Oregon. That's what you're really talking about if you really want to be ready. And to do that, you got to do, if there's a wetland delineation that's got to be done, you got to do in advance all the different issues. In the Portland metro area, quite frankly, it was about transportation infrastructure was the major issue there. And you got to find a way to have that in place or could be in place for a development to be able to go from permit to building in 180 days. You just got to be ready. So those are the kinds of things that were discussed in that first scenario.
Representative McEwen.
And Co-Chair Freeman, I appreciate your scenario, the one that you presented, because I think it's a common theme for those of us who live in our neck of the world collectively. But one of the things that keeps coming up is the 180-day idea. It's the time certain. And that's something that continues to come up in conversations that I have with economic development in my region, and I don't think I'm alone. But I think part of the emphasis here needs to be on continuing to try to strive for that time certain scenario where permitting, the quickest way to lose financing is go past the timing of which that financing has a shelf life. So I appreciate you bringing it up, and I just want to make sure that we continue during this process through regional solutions and through anything that we're doing to coordinate or streamline or any of those buzzwords that we're using right now to make sure that stays at the forefront of the conversation.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative McEwen, if I could, because this is an incredibly important issue and one that creates an incredible amount of tension. Our charge, as I said, in this process was not a what charge. So we weren't supposed to change the goalposts on regulatory policy. Our job was a how charge. How can we change those processes? How can we change the way we do business? And in my view, you're absolutely right. There are two issues here, cost and certainty. And if we can figure out ways to reduce the ambiguity of these systems, we're way ahead. I think one of the troubles we have, quite frankly, and this is where the 2.0 version might come in further discussions, is that there's a tension between these policies, a natural tension that actually isn't good or bad. It just is. We have good environmental regulations and conservation regulations. We have goods we are trying to create in community and economic development, and there is a tension between those goods. Our problem today is the time and uncertainty to reconcile the tension. And I think where we'll be going, if you want a little foreshadowing of 2.0, maybe 3.0, it is that we have to figure out ways of doing business that shorten and give more certainty to the reconciliation of that tension. And if we have to move resources closer to the actual problem in resources that may be human and capital resources so that we can work with communities in a more expeditious way, that isn't just human resource, but it's also authority and responsibility to make decisions about reconciliation, those are the kinds of next wave of discussions that have to occur if we're going to really get at that issue, because it's not an easy issue to get at. So.
Thank you.
Great. Well, that was a great presentation. We covered a lot of material rather quickly, so I'm guessing the panel may have additional questions that they can get to you. But thank you for being
Absolutely.
Here.
Absolutely.
Thank you for the work you're doing.
Thanks for having us.
That was very well said, Mr. Jordan.
Thank you.
So we're going to change the agenda just a little bit because I understand we have some folks that have traveled to be with us today. We might as well accommodate them. So we're going to move down to the identification of business organ programs yielding strongest results. And I believe we have Paul Grove that wants to come up. And would you like the rest of the panel to come up with you, or would you like to introduce the rest of the panel?
I will defer to the chair's direction or discretion on this one. I can provide a high-level overview.
Why don't you do the high-level overview, and then you can introduce sort of your folks that came to talk to us a little bit.
Sounds good. Thank you
for being here.
Thank you very much. Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Grove with the Oregon Business Development Department, Business Oregon, and I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today to talk a little bit about the department's programs, those programs that have proven successful, and to perhaps provide a brief snapshot of some priorities, if you will, around focus and interest areas that the department has, and then moreover hear from some of these businesses that have come here today and hear about their experience and what these programs have ultimately meant to them. That said, and with the focus being on the programs, if you will, I want to touch upon two things. I'm going to channel my inner director, Tim McCabe, really quickly, and as he would say if you were here today. These programs are meaningless unless you have the appropriate staff and resources to get out into the communities and help identify and address the issues and problems that present themselves for these companies or these communities. So I think if there was a overarching department priority outside of programmatic funding, if you will, it would be to have the staff level on the ground to help with these companies and communities. And secondly, while we do administer a number of programs, this is not done in isolation. These are done in partnership. And whether it's with the Oregon Manufacturing Extension Partnership, the Small Business Development Center Network, or others, we do not operate alone. We operate with the regional economic development entities throughout the state. And so the department is one piece of this overall puzzle in terms of helping administer and deliver the services through these programs. That said, just to touch upon a couple of these items, the first program, if you will, is the department's Industry Competitiveness Fund. And this is a very flexible tool that supports a host of activities, in particular providing technical assistance to manufacturers, supporting the Oregon Manufacturing Extension Partnership, and also helping small businesses with trade and export promotion. And you're going to hear from some companies today that have utilized those programs and have, I think, had some successful results at the end of the day. A second program priority area, if you will, is around the direct investment in these small businesses, and oftentimes this is done through the Governor's Strategic Reserve Fund or the newly created Business Expansion Program, where oftentimes the state is the last dollars in, if you will, on a particular deal in partnership with others, and they've had a very significant result in terms of the ROI with respect to the created jobs, jobs retained, as well as the revenues generated from these particular projects. The third priority area, if you will, would be around innovation, supporting the signature research centers and those other activities through the Oregon Innovation Council. Number four would be infrastructure development, and this can take a number of different shapes, but is oftentimes a critical component to laying the foundation for economic development and supporting small business growth in these rural communities. This can take the shape of supporting industrial land development, or there are particular ports-related projects that could include dredging that are of importance to ports and to the department and the state as a whole. So that is a high-level overview, if you will, of some programs or issue areas that we find and have found to be successful and that we would list out as priorities. But rather than hear from me, I think it would be beneficial for you guys to hear from these companies that have come here today to talk about their experience.
That was great. Thank you. And please invite them up, and we'll get to hear some success stories. It's always nice in the legislature when we get to hear some positive things. That's not always the case.
Well, I'll just ask them to all come join me, and they can introduce themselves. We have Kevin Bell with J&J Amusements, and then we have a couple of individuals here from OMEP and Cavdor, who has taken advantage of the OMEP services in the past. So
looks like we have George Fay and Michael Fowler. Great. Welcome. We'll get you right up here.
Thank you.
Sort of have this three-person panel design in our committee room. So thanks for being here. And wherever you'd like to start, tell us your story. That'd be great.
Thank you very much for having us and giving us the opportunity to address you. My name is George Fay, and I'm the board chair of Oregon Manufacturing Extension Partnership. I appreciate this opportunity to testify in support of the funding of the Manufacturing Extension Partnership in conjunction with Business Oregon. To give you an idea of my background, is I am a chemical engineer with an MBA by education. I spent 38 years in manufacturing, working at just about every level of manufacturing. And so I really have understood the agony of a small mid-sized business in competing with on a global stage. especially in an environment that de-emphasized manufacturing. And I saw the direct impact that loss of manufacturing job had on people and their families. Now, finally, after quite a few years, I think we as a country are recognizing the full importance of manufacturing on a state and federal level, what impact it has on the economy. And we have begun, which is going to be a very long journey, to revitalize and revive manufacturing. This journey will not be short and will cost a lot of money, but the returns will be enormous in turn of job creation for both direct hires and indirect impact on the community that the manufacturing facility is in. And, of course, you know, the tax revenue that it will create for state and federal governments. My job is a volunteer position. And the reason why I was anxious to join the Oregon Board of Directors is because I really wanted to give back something to them and help manufacturing on a basically state level, because closer to the source, you know, the more viable it is to help manufacturing. OMEP's mission is to create a stronger Oregon by helping small and mid-sized Oregon manufacturers become more competitive in the global marketplace. Basically, in other words, our mission is to go into a company that is typically small, typically privately held, typically undercapitalized, typically always short of funds, and funds are not really easily available at reasonable costs, and therefore they have to be more efficient in how they make a product in order to free up capital so they can invest in their future and grow. You can't grow if you're inefficient in manufacturing, because imagine that 70 cents of every dollar of sales that a company brings in has to go to manufacturing. That's raw materials and labor and overhead, strictly to make the product. So obviously that's a huge chunk of money. And if we can take and improve that 70 cents and drive it down, you know, that's a very significant amount. Obviously, as I said, I strongly believe in the importance of manufacturing. Because it supplies middle-class workers and their families a highest standard of living. Especially today, when we have a huge discussion about the disparity between classes of people, and we talk about the minimum wage. Well, manufacturing, 10 years ago, the company I was running was paying an average hourly rate of $23 an hour. Obviously, that truly elevates the standard of living of the workers involved. So OMEP's absolute goal is to create more jobs by basically elevating the level of quality of these companies, manufacturing companies, and therefore they can they can not only compete on a U.S. scale, but also there is now a trend of trying to bring back to the shores of the United States some of the jobs that we outsourced, because now people are finally looking at the total cost of outsourcing, and it's not cheap, as it turns out. So Oregon has a solid track record of creating value, as I described. According to a study recently completed by Portland State University, OMIP's work over the last 10 years has resulted in over $2 billion in economic impact and helped create or retain over 14,000 jobs. The return on the, obviously, on this investment to the taxpayer for small involvement in OMIP has been phenomenal. According to the PSU study, OMIP's assistance to companies has resulted in $11 million additional tax dollars collected between the year 2011 and 13. And we believe that we can do a lot more. The board has endorsed a strategy that will enable OMIP to double the number of clients it serves. But to accomplish this goal and reap the resulting benefits, it will be necessary for the state of Oregon to increase its investment from the current level of $500,000 per biennium to $1.555 million. That will provide a one-to-one match, and this is important for us because it will provide a one-to-one match to the federal subsidy we get, and therefore allow us to draw down the entire grant, which we really haven't been able to do. And obviously, we'll help OMIP hire more consultants that can then service more businesses. Right now, we're running at about 90 to 95% capacity, so we have to be very careful about how many more customers we bring on board with the current level of staffing. And part of this expansion, we want to be able to serve rural and small businesses as we can. So that's really the picture that we're confronted with. And on behalf of the OMIP board, I really appreciate this opportunity and thank you very much for listening.
Thank you for your comments, and I think you'll find amongst this panel, many of us are excited about the opportunity to have rural Oregon served in a variety of ways, but it sounds like you're doing great work, and I wish you the best with the funding request. You won't be alone in funding requests in the 2014 session, but keep trying. You're doing a great job. So,
absolutely.
I'm not sure who'd like to go next, but we'd love to hear from you.
Thank you. Yep,
happy to start.
Great, thank you.
Good morning, co-chairs, fellow chair members. Sorry, I'm just trying to follow the protocol that was laid out before. My name is Michael Fowler. I'm the CEO and co-owner of Cabinet Door Service. Together with my other two co-owners, we're a manufacturer of custom order cabinet parts for the professional custom cabinet maker. Specifically, my company builds cabinet doors, drawer fronts, dovetail drawers, all the accessory architectural millwork that's then supplied to a custom cabinet maker that's then installed in most typically a residential situation. We have over 1,000 customers, majority of which are located in the Pacific Northwest, California, Arizona, and have recently expanded into Canada. Employ 130 people. We have a single 48,000 square foot facility located over on Pringle Road. And just this month, we achieved a major milestone in that we celebrated 25 years being in business. In 2006, the housing boom, as you're all aware of, was in full swing. We had an opportunity at that time to meet with Tom Fox of Business Oregon, then at that time, Oregon Economic and Economic Community Development Department. This meeting was an outcome of a relationship CABDOR had formed over many years with Ray Klor, the business retention and expansion expert at SEDCOR. I think most of you know who that is, Strategic Economic Development Department. Used to be Salem Economic. But a dialogue ensued amongst these individuals about the challenges my company was facing. We could not keep up with the surge in demand, and at the time, nobody had forecasted the bubble was going to burst. Work in process was everywhere, tying up vast amounts of working capital. Defects on many of the products we generated actually were quite high, and it seemed like we were constantly in a crisis mode. That conversation led to an introduction to Oregon Manufacturing Extension Partnership, OMEP. They brought in a consultant, an industrial engineer, and he performed an initial assessment. This person had a fairly keen insight into myself and my other partners, in that he realized immediately that anything he was going to bring to the table had to be grounded in some fairly firm, verifiable data. When he had finished up his initial assessment, he showed us, fairly simple on the back of a piece of paper, how he believed that it was possible to reduce our manufacturing lead time at the time from 3 days. He said he could do it in 6 hours. Although we didn't initially believe him, the return on investment was so compelling that we said, great, what's the next step? At that point in time, Business Oregon then introduced us to what is now called Job Growers, formerly Enterprise Economic Development and Education. With their support, we undertook a lean education initiative where we basically brought all employees into the whole concept of lean education techniques and terminology. We then took that training, scrutinized every aspect of our business, knowing that everything that we needed to change basically started with the owners and worked its way down. Once applied company-wide, we realized it gave us a unique selling advantage because we were, in fact, able to prove on a trial basis that, yes, in fact, in a limited test situation, we could, in fact, build product in 6 hours. So as a result, we internalized that and began to build product faster and ship it quicker than our competitors, which in 2006 gave us a fairly considerable market advantage. At the same point in time, by stripping out the work in process, freed up a lot of extra working capital, and by turning around product a whole lot quicker, was able to QC product, quality control product, as it came through, so the defect rate actually went down, customers were happier. During the same time period, CABDOR was facing a dilemma with its physical location. We were the major tenant in a property in North Salem, and we, through a letter, learned that there was a legal battle brewing between the building owner and the bank. The outcome, the bank won, and essentially took over the property, voided our lease, and forced us to relocate. That imminent eviction, as we moved from a well-known lease in an established location to, oh, by the way, you have to relocate, caused us to have to explore a lot of options. This included the exploration of a property that's out on Portland Road, 168,000 square feet, $5 million property, and we thought we needed all the room in the world to expand and keep making product. We used all the lean training and our new understanding of one-piece flow to evaluate how much space we actually needed. By stripping out the racks of work in process, there was incomplete product everywhere. It allowed us also to reduce the raw material storage that we had on site. We ended up realizing that we could produce 40% more product, the same number of people, and actually less square footage than we actually were. So, in a way, we actually saved $5 million by not buying a building that was three times the square footage that we really didn't need. That OMEP, Business Oregon, SEDCOR, Job Growers Partnership allowed this critical thinking and discussion to happen that I don't know as partners we would have got to without that help. Business Oregon and OMEP have been key partners in our relocation to where we are at presently out on Pringle Road. They equipped us to refine the business plan to take to the bank. Additionally, Business Oregon stepped up with loan guarantees and the Business Development Fund. For the record, we actually pay off our Oregon Business Development Fund in June of this year, and we're nowadays operating without the Oregon Credit Enhancement Fund guarantee. So we've proven our viability in our new location. The move to the new space on Pringle finished up in May of 2007, and then, as some of you may recall, the housing market bubble that everybody forecasted that was going to burst did. It didn't so much as slow down sales. Sales stopped. It took us almost one full quarter to do what we had done in June in 1 month. To survive, we learned everything. To survive, we took everything we learned in going through the lean process, and again, with the help of OMEP and Business Oregon, and we used what we had initially taken to scale up the operation to intelligently scale back the operation in order to survive. As first quarter of 08 rolled through into spring, we once again sat down with OMEP and Business Oregon partners, and out of that conversation, I think we did something that's relatively unprecedented. We hired two new salesmen. This was against the advice of our bank, but we just decided that we could not cut our way to profitability. We believed we could leverage the capacity and the people and in the process that we created, but we had to do it by finding new customers and new sales. We've been blessed since then with the ability to grow year-over-year sales and are nearly back to 2007 sales levels. The training and coaching that OMEP brought to the table, the Business Oregon helped put together along with the partnerships with SEDCOR and Job Growers, have been critical. The tenaciousness of my partners and my employees are the reason that CABDOR is still here. We've become smarter. Our core strength that we have realized is our people, and our people do the best they can with the systems that we give them. If they fall short, it's my fault. We've embraced that we are a training organization. Cross-training, skill upgrades, continuous improvement, all are part of our culture. From our inception, we had a passion about helping the custom cabinet shop be more successful, and this continues, and we continue that to this day. We believe we now carry on a set of living, breathing values that guide every discovery process and decision within the company. Thank you.
Well, what a great story.
That's a great story.
Yeah. Thank you for coming and sharing that with us. And I think most of us here are small business owners and understand the difficulty of running a business, especially this last few years has been pretty tough. And to hear you've succeeded through that is really inspiring. So thank you for being here. Let's go ahead with the next panelist, and we might do some questions here at the end. Thanks.
Okay. First of all, my name is Kevin Bell. I work for a company located here in Salem called J&J Amusements. We manufacture go-karts and bumper boats and sell them all over the world. I didn't have time to prepare a speech. I'm sorry, because this is a really busy time of year, so
good.
It was hard for me to pull away
busy.
For this amount of time. We worked with Business Oregon for some of their trade grants, which allowed us to explore exporting in different markets. We've been in business since the 70s, actually. Started with just bumper boats. We actually designed a bumper boat, patented the bumper boat, and sold that to amusement parks. Then we went on to the go-karts, which, of course, they were already around, but over time developed the actually most durable, safest go-kart in the market. We are the largest concession go-kart manufacturer, which makes us a big fish in a small pond. We sell about 400 units a year of the carts and 300 bumper boats. We had gotten orders from overseas prior to working with Business Oregon, but it was always they found us, or they heard of us, or they would do some exploring on the internet. The one thing with our market is we don't sell to the general public. We're a very niche market. They, you know, have to come to a trade show and find out about you. So there are trade shows overseas, and we had talked about doing them, and we'd save money, and we do one a year, and just kind of throw the caution to the wind and see if we'd get some sales. After working with them, we ended up doing a couple, and that market is hard to get into, especially in foreign. We're competing against manufacturers from China. Their equipment is considerably less money than ours, but it's also very much disposable, where ours will last 10, 20 years. Not to mention they don't have to comply with the regulations that we do in the United States that relate to safety, mainly safety, but durability. Our cars also have to comply with EPA regulations that they can't leak any vapor from the gas tank, where the ones from China do not. So getting into those markets, it was a tough sell because there was such a price difference. But going to the show and becoming, you know, continually, they would see that I'm a familiar face, where the companies from China would be one name one year, different name next year. Sometimes they'd be around, sometimes they wouldn't. So continually going to these shows ended up, during the recession, you know, obviously companies in the U.S., which is 60-70%, actually probably closer to 80% of our market, were not buying cars. But we managed to keep our profit levels up by exporting. This year alone, I brought a list of new customers that we sold to outside the U.S., includes Nicaragua, Guatemala, Puerto Rico, United Kingdom, Japan, Nigeria, United Kingdom, Indonesia, Latvia, Saudi Arabia, Norway, Poland, Nigeria, Dubai, Colombia, Tunisia, and Peru. And just this morning before this meeting, I was speaking with a customer in Amsterdam. Our company, you know, is obviously a small company. We're employee-owned. There's 20 people that work there full-time. And during this time, we would have been laying people off when the economy was not going well. We actually have been bringing people on. We have saved two jobs that normally we would lay off consistently every year. Those people are now full-time. We're actually now going to be looking at this summer bringing on more people. And then also our vendors range. We don't build the cars in-house. I don't bring in steel and build them there. We're more like a car manufacturer, where I work with companies that have big tools and equipment that we can't afford. So I have vendors. I have frames built in Eugene. I have multiple vendors in Portland. I have vendors in Dundee, Independence. And like that gentleman said before, 75 cents and every dollar goes to manufacturer. I'd actually disagree. It's probably closer to 79 cents. So we're spreading a lot of money around Portland or the Oregon. It's not exclusive to Oregon. We do have some vendors elsewhere, but I would say 50-60%, if not more, are vendors. And we always try to stay local. It gives us the ability to work more closely with those vendors and do quality control. And it's also a lot more impressive when I have a client come to town and I can take him to the machine shop building our parts, and they get to see the robots and the different machines doing their work, and I'm saying, this is my go-kart. So that's about our company. Those grants actually did so well that I went ahead and signed up for two trade shows. The end of this month, I leave for Mumbai, India, and in March, I'll be in Dubai.
Wonderful. Well, some of us in the legislature have had a chance to go to the world's largest trade show in China, and I can see the challenge to get to all the different trade shows around the world, and there's a lot of customers out there sometimes we don't think about. So
yeah.
It's a very impressive list of customers you have from around the world, and that's certainly something I would not have known about. And I'm going to call on my co-chair, Representative Barton, here in a second, but we may want to schedule a visit. And
oh, yeah.
See. Oh, yeah. I'm all about bumper boats.
Oh, yeah. I actually have a sign in my office that numbers the number of countries that we're in, and every year that number is growing. When I first started this project, it was in the 30s. We're now up to 57.
Wow.
Congratulations. Representative Barton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Bell, thank you for coming in. Representative Gomberg sells kites for a living. And before today, that was the coolest job I'd ever heard of. But you've cleared the bar. You've raised it up, selling go-karts and bumper boats for a living. You, sir, are a hero. And really appreciate your coming in. Thank you.
Other comments, Representative Thatcher?
Yeah, I appreciate the comments of both gentlemen. And you, Michael, you laid out very well some of the questions that I had in my mind before this started, and that is how you made contacts with the right folks to get the ball rolling. And I wonder how, did they come to you, or did you find them somehow?
I found them.
And how?
Actually, funny enough, there's a bumper car company in Independence. We're not direct competitors. They don't sell the same product I do. We refer each other all the time. Mm-hmm. And I asked them, how do you, they're a smaller company than we are, much smaller. And I asked, how do you go to all these trade shows, the foreign trade shows? First of all, how do you do in these foreign trade shows? Is it worthwhile? Is it something I need to be doing? And they told me, yes, it's grown their market. And they said, have you ever heard of Business Oregon? So I hadn't, and I started by attending a seminar that they put on in Portland about, you know, assistance. Well, actually, it was more on how to get involved in shipping and questions that would help you get better at it. And then they brought that up, so then I contacted them and the ball went rolling from there. I was really surprised how easy it was.
So it was kind of a networking,
yes.
You know, a lead,
yes,
that got you there. Do any of these programs, you know, having the industrial consultant engineer people come in, does that cost money, or how does that work?
No, they're hired as an outside contractor, and so there is a billable rate to have them involved. OMEP's expensive,
yeah.
But when we sit down on pencil and paper and turn around and look at what the current state is and where you potentially want to be in the future, and you look at the return that you can achieve with their help, and we've had such good success that as a result nowadays that the burden is not as high as it was initially, because we've had such good success and we keep getting the same consultant back. So we've kept the same individual directly engaged since 2006.
Representative McEwen.
Co-Chair Freeman, that begs a question from me. I am just so delighted to hear your stories. It gives us all hope that we're going to come out of this recession successfully, and you all have navigated it well. But is there a point in time that you see kind of divesting of your relationship with OMEP? Is this a one-time thing? It sounds like you've been at it for quite a while and have continued to, and you still have an opportunity to seek services. But is there a point where you won't need them anymore?
In our operation, is as you go down that path of true continuous improvement in the manufacturing, there's initial, so to speak, low-hanging fruit,
mm-hmm,
that you'll go after initially, and then there's a series of initiatives that you want to go after, but management time is so necessarily limited. You can only get to so many things within a given calendar year, and so we've continued to roll through additional initiatives, set up production, pay for performance, and then as you roll into those levels, those then peel back additional opportunities and places to expand. And I think there's going to be a place for quite a while, especially with our growth aspirations, for OMEP to have a place at the table, because they're going to bring expertise to the table that I just physically my partners don't have.
Okay, thank you.
Just to be clear, I've only used it twice and haven't in the last 2 years.
Okay, but at some point in the future, would you take advantage of that opportunity again?
Yeah, actually, I'm talking with them now, because the ones that bear fruit, I have obviously said, okay, this is a worthwhile venture, and I will take the risk, and I will do this on my own. Some others have come up. It's nice having that as a possibility. So I'm looking into it. I'm not going to say that I'm going to use it.
Mm-hmm.
But I do look into it. So I've only used the program twice, 2 years ago.
Great.
After
Thank
that, this year was all us.
Great. Thank
so,
you.
So I'm going to apologize to the task force. And, David, I'm going to see you next week in Roseburg. So I have to leave, but I'm going to hand over the task force to Co-Chair Barton. And thank you for being here.
Representative Gumbert.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and thank you, gentlemen. Mr. Bell, I don't know if your job is cooler than mine, but I have no doubt it's as cool, and I'd be happy to schedule some time for the committee to do some comparative analysis. that being said, you talked to us a little bit about your experience at trade shows, dealing with your offshore competition face-to-face. Do you have any perspective on online competition and whether these folks are what's going on the internet in terms of marketing in your particular product area?
In regards to the porn competition?
Yes.
It's a very big competitive area. As a matter of fact, I could give you get on a computer in 5 minutes, show you a competitor advertising them selling a product that is comparable to mine and using my pictures. It's actually pictures of my equipment being used, and they are saying that they sell. It's a bumper boat. And yeah.
Mr. Cochero,
please.
That's exactly the answer I was looking for, because I can go online in 5 minutes and I can show you pictures taken from my web pages. In fact, I can show you pictures of offshore competitors using photos that I'm in.
Yeah.
Wow.
And the process of trying to confront them, it's almost not worth my time. They're located in China. I'd have to get counsel in China. They've actually gone to the extent of taking off my decals or color covering them with Photoshop. Hmm. And I can find that same picture elsewhere on the internet from a customer of mine, and they've just stole it. And go-karts, too.
Exactly the same experience. I see that happening to small manufacturers across the board.
Hmm. And we don't have the money to fight it.
Any more questions or comments for this panel? Gentlemen, thank you guys for coming in. Really great stories. It's great to hear from you.
Continued good luck.
Thank you.
So we are going to close that informational hearing, and our final agenda item, we're going to have an informational meeting. We're going to hear from the Employment Department. Come on up regarding the unemployment insurance claims resolution process. And I know Representative Freeman, sorry he's not here, because this is a particular interest of his, as you know, but thank you again for coming in, and as you often do.
Well, certainly. Thank you, Co-Chair Barton, members of the committee. For the record, David Gerstenfeld, Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance at the Employment Department. And I'll be sensitive to the time, but wanted to just give an update to some of what we talked about in September when I talked about the claims resolution process and a few specific items that we're doing to try to improve that process. And I'm actually going to shift which one I talk about first, because I was very heartened to hear the experience of one of the members of the prior panel talking about the lien process, because that's something that we're undertaking in the near future. We're going to be getting some outside expertise to help us go through that for the unemployment insurance claims process with an eye to making it a smoother process from the public's perspective. We anticipate that we'll get some efficiencies, but we're really focusing on making it a more user-friendly process to where people aren't having to wait to hear from us and then rush to get back to us. We want it to be a smoother one. One of the specific items that I talked about in September was that we do have a computer tool that we use. It's a national tool that we take advantage of to allow employers to communicate with us about claims for benefits. And there's one system for larger employers that requires a lot more IT sophistication, and then there's a web-based one that any employer can use. We think that the tool offers a lot of advantages for employers, but it hasn't been used as widely as we would like. So we looked at why, and we've made some changes, and we're making more changes to that. One of the changes that we have already made was improving the system on our end for businesses to use it. When they get a notice that a claim was filed, they have to have a PIN number that is specific to the claim. And it sounds like a simple thing to get the PIN number generated and on that notice, but a lot of pieces of information have to align up correctly. And it's based off information that people are giving us when they file their claim for benefits. So if someone types in the name of their employer wrong, it wasn't putting a PIN when the notice went out. There were a lot of issues like that, or people that worked for multiple employers. So we changed our system quite a bit in October. Previously, about 44% of the notices that we mailed had that PIN number, and those employers could take advantage of the system. Other employers were not able to because they didn't have the PIN for the claim. We've increased that up to 81% now, and we have some other changes that we think will make some smaller incremental increases. We'll never be at 100% because of some of the issues, but that should help significantly. We've seen the number of responses that we get also about double, so that's encouraging. There are some other barriers, though. One is that the system is not as intuitive as we would like. It is a national system, so we can't change how the system operates or looks once an employer gets into it. We are providing feedback to the national group that administers the system. And the other thing that we're working on are some guides to help employers understand so that it's easier, so that at least if it's not going to be intuitive, there are some quick tips, some guides that employers can use so that it's easier to handle. We're developing those. We expect to have those done by the end of next month. And once we have those, we're going to do some concerted outreach to employers, find out if those guides work. If not, find those. The last piece, which is the part that we're most excited about but will take the longest, is right now that process still starts with us mailing a notice on paper so that people can then access the electronic system with the PIN. We'd like to move to doing that via email for employers that want it by email. That gives them more time to respond. It's a lot more flexible if they have multiple operations, or especially for small businesses, if they don't have a set address and they may be traveling, they can access it anywhere. That's a more complicated feature to implement. We are working on that, and we anticipate having that done towards the end of the summer. We want to be cautious as we're doing that we don't break the system or create unintended consequences. Once that's done, we anticipate that employers will get the notices a lot quicker. They'll be able to respond to us more quickly. It'll be more flexible, so we're excited about that. And the last kind of initiative that I was going to mention is one that I will be seeing Representative Freeman next week. He was kind enough to pass on some concerns from some of his constituent businesses, and I spoke to some of those business owners, and they had not had positive experiences dealing with us on particular claims. Talked to them about what the experiences were, what caused the problems, and there were some specific items that some that we can address and some that frankly are outcome-based, that are statutory, that we can't. But the larger issue that I saw was that we were not effectively getting those concerns raised to us. We weren't aware of all the frustrations and all the concerns. So we're trying to set up an ongoing communication. This is starting with a series of sessions throughout the state, so we have four scheduled for next week, and then we'll be scheduling more throughout the state later in the year. So next week I will be in Roseburg, Grants Pass, Medford, and Bend, and we have about 140 participants signed up. We have, I know the one in Bend, they ran out of room for the room, so we'll be going back there, and we will be planning them for other parts of the state later in the year, and that's something that we're certainly happy to provide the information to members of this task force and others so that can be shared with local businesses. The goal is to give some information about the unemployment insurance program and changes, but also to have a discussion with them about what their experiences are so that I can hear firsthand what things we need to work on, and hopefully set up more of an ongoing discussion so frustrations don't build up over time. And with that, I know that we've run a little long, so I want to be sensitive to your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
I'm good. Appreciate the update.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. You got off easy today. Again, thank you for coming in with the update. Appreciate your keeping us posted. And
thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there any further business? Actually, I think there is. If you can bear with us another 5 to 10 minutes, would you like to take this opportunity to discuss your proposed legislation that's going to be coming up in February?
Do you have one you want to present?
Mm-hmm.
I know both of you have heard that. So two of our members are working on some legislation in the February session. We don't yet know where they will go. You are welcome to storm the dais or speak from up here as you prefer.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, colleagues. For the record, David Gomberg, House District 10 on the Central Oregon Coast. I'm introducing this week a proposal that would make some adjustments to the small business tax cut approved during the most recent special session. Of course, you recall, just a few months ago, we came together and approved a measure that would adjust the tax rates for S corporations and LLCs in an effort to try and create a level playing field between the rates that they pay
and the rates that larger corporations, C corporations, pay in Oregon. I supported that measure, but on reflection, I think that there's some opportunities to make some improvements, and I don't think it's too soon to talk about those improvements, even though it's only been just a few months. And my measure addresses two points. The first one deals with the requirements that a small company would have to satisfy in order to qualify for the tax cut. What we said is that you had to employ you needed to have employees that would work 1,200 hours or more a year, and it would only count if those employees worked for a total of 30 hours or more a week. 1,200 hours a year, 30 hours a week. In my district, that doesn't work very well. It doesn't work all the time. It doesn't work for seasonal industries like fishing, for farming, for tourism. It doesn't work for potential employees that may be working parents, may be working seniors. In my district, a lot of people that are working full-time do so by holding two or three part-time jobs. And so my suggestion was that we adjust that requirement and adjust it slightly so that we're talking, instead of 30 hours a week, 20 hours a week. Instead of talking 1,200 hours a year, we would be talking 1,000 hours a year. And with that seemingly small adjustment, we found that an additional 8,000 companies in Oregon would be brought into the system. 8,000 companies, presumably small micro businesses, seasonal industries, and rural areas. So we're not only bringing in a lot of new companies, 8,000 companies at cost of about $7 million, but I think we're also possibly doing a better job of reaching those small businesses than we do with the original measure. And I say that to you because currently in Oregon we have about 80,000 S-corporations. And of those 80,000, 40,000 of them, half of them, are reporting incomes of under $25,000 a year, taxable income, $25,000 a year. That means that those folks are going to be getting a tax break in the neighborhood of $130 a year. The 8,000 companies that I'm talking about at a cost of $7 million would be getting closer to about $900 a year. So we're providing a more substantial benefit to another 8,000 companies. Cost of $7 million, where's the money come from? That comes to the second point in my measure. One of the concerns I had with what we did is the unintended consequences. We know how many companies we've got right now. What we don't know is what may happen when larger companies decide to restructure themselves to take advantage of the lower tax rates now available to S-Corps and LLCs. We have no idea what that's going to cost. I suggested that we address that by putting a cap on the amount of income that can be subjected to the newer lower rates. And my measure says that we cap that that benefit at $250,000. Now, that doesn't mean that if you make more than $250,000 that you don't get any tax break. It just means you just get to count the first $250,000, giving you a tax break of roughly $5,000 a year, and saving the state of Oregon about $24 million in the process. So $24 million coming from about 3,000 companies, but on the other end of the process, being able to bring about 8,000 new companies into the process at a cost of $7 million. It's interesting that if you want to actually adjust that cap and take it up to $1 million, that we're only going to give you a tax break on the first $1 million that you earn in your small business, that we'd be affecting 250 companies in the state at a cost of about $10 million. So if we raise the cap to $1 million, my proposal becomes revenue neutral for the most part, and that we'd have a pathway to pay for it and to move it forward during the February session. Again, the major concern I've got is reaching out to more companies in seasonal industries, in rural areas, and reaching out to people that employ working parents, working seniors, really spreading the benefits of the measure that we passed in a more meaningful way. An average of about $1,000, $900 tax savings a year, rather than most of the companies that are currently going to be getting less than $150. That's the measure I've introduced, and I don't think it's too early to talk about it.
Thank you, Representative. You will recall, we sit next to each other on the floor, of course, and so you will recall during the special session how I became somewhat unhinged when discussing this proposal. I had just started to regain some kind of psychological equilibrium, and I'd like to thank you for taking me back to the abyss. Is there any other discussions.
Thank you.
And anything else? Thank you, Representative. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. The proposal that I have is basically the goal is to review all state business licensing programs, the fees, the regulations that are underlying all the costs to a business to fee, license, all that stuff. Now, I suggested going through a vehicle we've used before, and that is similar to the Joint Tax Credit Committee, where they would be tasked with figuring out what is appropriate. Maybe some of these licenses need to be eliminated. Maybe some of these licenses need to be expanded or broken down to smaller pieces, providing less cost. And I kind of like going back to the hairdresser or the hair braiders, where we took them out of this requirement to spend nearly 1,500 hours in school and thousands of dollars getting trained to do something that they're not interested in doing. They're interested in doing something over here, and it should be a lot a smaller undertaking for them. I like using that pattern. I would like to use that pattern for a lot of the licensing and registration, et cetera, that are out there at the state level. Start taking a bite at, I guess, the Big Apple of all the costs that go into running a business in the state. I'm open to different ways of approaching this. I was just suggesting through this bill, looking at a legislative joint legislative committee that would be looking into these things, and maybe working with, as we had Michael Jordan speaking this morning, maybe working with the regional solutions people somehow, connecting to that. I don't know what that would look like, but it seemed like they were interested in very similar things. So that's basically it. I just think that some of these things just kind of get out of control, and we need to take a step back and reevaluate.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions for Representative Thatcher?
I'm good.
Thank you very much. Representative Thatcher, actually, I do. Is anyone co-chiefing that with you? Did I?
I hear that there's a very nice kite builder.
That's what I heard. Yeah, just checking.
Yeah, I don't know.
You guys are such troublemakers. Thank you very much. It's a genuinely good idea, and we look forward to working.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Barton, the Kite Caucus is fully supportive of this measure.
Great. So, having said that, is there any further business to come before the task force today? We are adjourned. Thank you very much. See you in February. Very much. We'll see you in February. We're adjourned. Thank you.